Choo-choo train.
Look at them.
Choo-choo train.
And can you say the EdTech podcast?
The EdTech podcast.
Try again. The EdTech podcast.
The EdTech podcast.
Try like this. EdTech.
EdTech to the podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the EdTech podcast, the show about improving the dialogue between ed and tech for better innovation and impact. My name is Sophie Bailey and I'm recording this episode the day after England won on penalties, shock horror, to get through to the quarterfinals in the World Cup. Nail-biting stuff, and I wonder how the World Cup is affecting your working week, student concentration or not, as the case may be. This week's podcast features a smorgasbord of guests. First up, a Chinese AI company in conversation with a US Army learning scientist and standards boards on technology in education. I speak to Richard Tong from Songshu AI Learning in China, Robert Sotelet, Associate Director for Training Technology at the US Army Research Lab, Avron Barr, Chair for the IEEE Learning Technology Standards Committee, and Robbie Robson, the CEO of EduWorks. I spoke to this group at the London Festival of Learning, and we explore what the profession of learning engineering could bring to new software innovation, which truly understands pedagogy. They are seeking help on building up standards in this area and of AI in education, and you can find out how to be involved. Continuing the big theme of interdisciplinary learning and knowledge sharing from the London Festival of Learning, next we skip over the pond to a past recording from South by Southwest EDU, where I talk to Rachel French, an associate architect from DLR Group, talking about the use of space design for learning and what she picked up from a year spent researching this in Australia. And finally, I'm chatting to Preben Hansen from Danish company Cubo Robot and Stefan Turnipseed, the Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer from Pitsco Education from the US, on screenless technologies to naturalise the teaching of computing at ever earlier years. So a very eclectic mix, and that's how we like it. But before all that, this week I've been reading Joe Nutt's TES article on research schools in the UK and the twisting of the word evidence to fit various edtech or educational agendas on what works. If you fancy a read, go and check that out. I'll pop the link in the show notes. It was a timely article as this week I have been chatting to Finnish organisation Cocoa, fresh back from ISTE, about the efficacy certificate. If you'd like to check out their quality standard for learning solutions, do let me know and I'll hook you both up. And finally, the Times Higher Education podcast have joined the lineup for the EdTech Podcast Festival. If you're in London in September, come and listen to how the TEH found value in sharing content on their podcast channel and how you might go about doing the same. 50% of tickets are now booked and we're looking forward to welcoming you all. That's all for now. If you're still in the World Cup, enjoy. If you couldn't give a monkey's, enjoy your week wherever you may be. Bye-bye. So it's wonderful to be here. It's not as sunny as yesterday, but it's still a glorious day in central London. And we're in Russell Square at the London Festival of Learning. And I'm delighted to be here with Richard Tong, who is the Chief Architect and General Manager at
the Songshu AI.
And you were giving me some pronunciation lessons earlier, so I need to work on that somewhat. And we were having conversations. So first of all, I was interested very much in what you're doing and how that's powering whether it's your own technologies for education or powering others as a sort of engine in that sense. And then we got talking also about the sort of standards body around technologies and education. And so I have three other gentlemen here, from no doubt from all over the world, who I thought would make a great conversation for our listeners, just to explain a little bit about what work is happening in standards in technology and education, and also specifically and perhaps more recently in artificial intelligence standards. So I don't know who'd like to jump in first.
Well, I'll introduce myself first. My name is Avrin Barr. I'm a consultant in Silicon Valley, and I've been the chair of the IEEE's Learning Technology Standards Committee for several years. There's a lot happening there. We'll talk about that.
Hi, I'm Bob Sadler. I work for the U.S. Army. I'm a scientist in learning sciences, where learning sciences intersect with machine learning. And we developed a open source intelligent tutoring framework called GIFT, the Generalized Intelligent Framework for Tutoring. And I'm a recently appointed working group chair under the LTSC that Avrin chairs.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, hi, I'm Robbie Robson. I'm CEO of EdgeWorks Corporation. We do applications of AI and machine learning to learning, education, and training and some other areas. I'm also the former chair of the IEEE LTSC for about 8 years, and am on the IEEE Standards Association Standards Board and their Future Directions Committee, and several other of those positions.
Okay, thanks for all introducing yourselves. I mean, I suppose first question, quite broad one. Our listeners are a mix of people working in education, so whether that's early years right up to higher education and beyond, and then the other side, so investors, startups, publishers, policymakers. So for those people listening in, what should they know about standards in technology in education that you're discussing as you're the kind of center of your work?
Well, I'll start. Generally, when people buy their first set of products, they're not too worried about standards. If they're working with a single vendor like Pearson, they're not too worried about standards. But as soon as they try to build a solution that has multiple vendors involved, they realize that some of those products don't talk to other products and they need them to. And that's where standards will come in. We're really early in the cycle now, but we've already seen some market problems that people are asking for solutions for that standards could help. I'll give you an example. These days, people are using augmented reality to help train people and to help them during their work job as performance support systems. To do that, they build a model of their working environment and they augment it with video or sound or something like that so that students or workers can get some help, interventions as they do their job. Well, these days, you build that environment, you build that model in a particular augmented reality system, which is fine until you decide you want to move on to the next augmented reality system from another vendor. Then you have to build the whole thing all over again. So we are working on a standard that allows you to export from one system a model that you can import into another system. Really simple. That's really what standards are supposed to be, simple. But it's complicated enough that it's taken a while to produce the standard, and it will really help the market, both for the existing players in the market and for innovators, new players who can then enter the market and pull the models from the existing systems that people have already built and get a head start.
Interesting.
Yeah, I would like to add a little to that, because I'm from the kind of like the innovation part of the world, and we are like building the whole adaptive system for the China, the K-12 after school market. And, we have been growing really fast. And a lot of that is due to we're taking advantage a lot of the work that has been previously done in the whole education technology world. And for innovators, the thing is that we have to be super, super focused. We cannot invent everything. We can only invent what is really relevant. For that, we need a lot of components that we can plug into our system without reinventing the wheels. And secondly, we also want to leverage not only the component, but also the architecture for a lot of the thinking that has been already tested. Like the one that we're talking about, like the GIFT, the standard, and also the thing that I have done a lot in the past with MS Global, with CEDS, the U.S., Common Education Data Standard, is that once we see how a certain design pattern has been already implemented and standardized, we know for sure that is a very high likelihood that it has been battle proven, and we can have a good quality out of box by putting that into our new platform. And for all of those reasons, we are actually, you know, really eager to learn what the current standard can bring to us, especially as innovators. We don't have a lot of time, like a Pearson or whatever can send a whole bunch of people to all these conferences, right? We want to say, okay, can we go to somebody and say, here is a reference architecture, here are something that has been tested, here are some use cases, and we can immediately use that and then put our innovation on top of that and contribute back, right? Because we want to also contribute back. Actually, our chairman recently announced two initiatives. One is that we want to donate 1 million seats of our AI platform to disadvantaged kids around the world so that they can take advantage of the AI tutor that we're building. But somebody got to put in content, right? In order to do that, we have to have a standard way to getting content into our platform. And we want to use a IEEE or, you know, IMS Global type of standard that can enable that. And second initiative we also talked about is that we want to open up our AI platform and make it open source to the whole world so that people like, you know, the US Army or people like in a Indian, you know, elementary school innovator can also take advantage of that, because we think that education is such a big game. We cannot stop, and we have to really collaborate, because the key thing is not only about how to build technology, but also to have people to adopt the paradigm shift. Because, you know, the thing that we're using, the AI and all the adaptive thing, these are paradigm shift revolutions. This has to be adopted by a lot of people in order for it to work, not only for technologists, but also for parents, for educators, for people to believe in that.
Well, that's a really interesting segue, because you mentioned parents and educators, and I was having a conversation with someone yesterday about, you know, there is, you know, obviously there's been a few headlines around data and so on this year, and, you know, parents and educators are unsurprisingly sort of questioning some aspects of that. So how do you kind of incorporate some of these questions into when you're developing these standards? And I'm thinking specifically around, you know, the personalized learning, adaptive learning, artificial intelligence. What kind of discussions have you had around that?
Yeah, so I'll take that. I'm going to actually talk about two things. So one is one of the projects that we're involved in is with some of the organizations that we just mentioned, is how do you share this knowledge and skills and abilities that somebody knows across boundaries. So right now, traditionally, all of the educational systems have been in silos. So somebody went to school, they stayed at that school for 8 years, maybe they went to a university. Well, with online education, they're getting courses from multiple sources, and these all have to be interchanged. So one of the problems that standards are solving is how do you do those interchanges? At the IEEE, though, one of the big global initiatives, and the IEEE is a large organization, about 450,000 people internationally, is in ethics and AI. And there's a series of standards that's being developed that talks about how you should develop AI systems. So, for example, what are they good for? What kind of transparency is needed? How do you understand what the algorithms are doing? And I mean, the first time that an AI fails a student, we're going to have a problem. All right, and at that's the point at which we need to understand what did that AI do? And by the way, the data that was used to train it, was that prejudiced in some way? Did we use data sets from only America, and then we tried to apply it in China, and it turns out that the way that people in China are culturally biased is different than in America? And so these kinds of issues are being developed in a series of standards. One of them in the LTSC is on student data and governance, and looking very much at sort of international standards for how technology is built and the processes that the technology uses to govern and to store and to secure and ensure the privacy and applicability of student learning and student data.
So we definitely care about what you just talked about, Robbie, but we also are working some problems that are focused on making it easier to use this technology so that AI can supplement what would normally be done by a person. So content development. So if it's scenario-based, it's a game or some virtual environment, an augmented environment, you know, what kinds of variables are there? How can I use those variables and then apply it to a computer model and say, okay, I want to generate thousands of variations of this particular scenario, and then I want to rank them with their relevance to learning objectives, right? And I don't want a person to do that. I want a machine to do that. That's a really hard problem, one of the problems that the U.S. Army is trying to tackle. In another vein is, you know, we talked a little bit about learner modeling is, you know, how much do you need to know about that particular learner? Or how much do you need to know about a domain in terms of the measures? And to reduce that to some essential set of things that a machine has to know in order to be able to deliver satisfactory instruction, right? Or even excellent instruction. So.
One more thing for the public and the various stakeholders to know in the way of what we're trying to do to help. We think there's a missing profession of engineers, people trained as engineers who know about learning technology, who know about data governance for children and students, who know about the various different regulations or the various different products that are out there so that they can help solve problems and build solutions. So the IEEE has just recently launched a project called IEEE Icicle to look at what that profession would look like, what the curriculum for training those people would look like, and try to develop the profession over the next couple of years to see if we can help people learn how to help people.
And is that kind of why, what brings you to this festival, which is more the academic side and that kind of thing?
Exactly. We're here part to recruit people to this all-volunteer effort at the IEEE, and in particular to try to get a more global footprint, more international participation, because learning engineering as a discipline is going to be very different in different kind of markets.
We've been working on this since January. There's about 65 companies ranging from small ed tech companies like those represented here to Google, which is probably a large company. and that's just been in 6 months, literally. And there's about almost 300 people working on it, about 100 of which are actively working in various special interest groups trying to define a curriculum for learning engineering at universities. I believe Boston College just started a program that's actually called Learning Engineering. Carnegie Mellon has a program in it. We're just talking to some people here from UCL because a lot of what this group is doing here in this incubator is relevant to that. That's on one side, and then there are interest groups that are looking at applications of VR and AI on standards on all of these kinds of things. So
is it trying to create that unique person that has the sort of pedagogical understanding, but also the sort of engineering?
So
as well?
Yeah. So I mean, I guess the way I would put it is, you when you drive over a bridge, you'd like to know that it was built by a civil engineer who understands how bridges work.
Yeah,
okay. When you engage with learning technology, wouldn't it be nice to know it was built by a learning engineer who knows how learning works? And that's essentially what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of skills that are involved. Standards are one of them, but so is learning science and understanding how these things, all of the technology, AI, you know, for example, we're talking about ethical applications of AI. That's important for a learning engineer to understand, not necessarily to understand how every little algorithm works any more than a civil engineer needs to learn understand the quantum mechanics that's holding the molecules together. But they certainly need to understand how AI works in general and how it's applied to learning in specific. So those are the kinds of things that we're trying to promote.
And so if people are listening in, who would you invite to join your membership or to the Icicle as well?
Sure. So anybody who's interested in designing, in working with, in what's called now instructional design, in designing the technology, people who build technology, learning technology, people who are in computer science who want to work in learning technology. One of the things I've discovered here is that an awful lot of the people at this conference started in computer science and have moved over to departments of education. So those are the kinds of people that we're very keen to have. We're also keen to have people who are innovating in, you know, in VR and AR and in all of these areas. So anybody that's really interested in being a professional that's involved in developing, designing, deploying, and using learning systems.
I would add to that, from a stakeholder standpoint, large government organizations, right? Military organizations or departments of education, people who are going to be, you'll want to be smart buyers, right? To understand the value of the technology and to be able to look across different product lines and understand the ability to either reuse it or be interoperable with it with systems that they already have.
One more class of stakeholders. Once you start using technology in the classroom, for example, you realize that the classroom has to change. Eventually, you realize that the school might have to be changed because of the implications of the technology or even the whole educational system. That's engineering, too. So we want people who are looking at the implications and ramifications of technology as well as the technologists.
And I would definitely add my constituents, which are the innovators in this space, because, you know, for those people, we have several ways or several, you know, demands in this area. One is that we need professionals who are trained with the right combination of skills, learning science, artificial intelligence, computer science, as well as instructional design and pedagogy. So for those type of people that we're recruiting, we want to see where they can get those type of training and also what are the essential skills they need to have. And the other part is the, as we just talked about earlier, the standard as a whole is a must-have for the innovators, right? Because the innovators, they cannot do everything by themselves, and they would need to understand the bigger landscape of where things already are and what are the things that need to be innovated, what are the things that need to be stay stable so that innovation does not, you know, go by itself.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Brilliant. So I am here with Rachel French from the DLR Group. And Rachel's job title is K-12 Education Planner and Researcher. So welcome.
Thank you.
So Rachel, could you tell us a little bit about, you've just come straight from a workshop that you were running here at South by Southwest EDU and what that was and, you know, what your day-to-day world entails?
Sure. So the workshop was kind of reflecting, I really wear two hats right now. So one hat is my architectural educational planner hat with DLR Group, to where I kind of run visioning sessions and work with schools to really think about how they teach, what they want learning to look like, and then work with the design team to really ensure that the spaces deliver and can really support that practice. My other hat, which was the workshop, what it was focused on is my researcher hat. So I spent last year, almost all of 2017, in Melbourne, Australia, on a Fulbright scholarship working with a research project called Innovative Learning Environments and Teacher Change. And what this team is doing is it's a research project out of the Learning Environments Applied Research Network from the University of Melbourne. Sorry, lots of words. But basically, this research group is a collaboration of the College of Architecture and the College of Education. So all they do is study learning environments, and they've been around for over a decade now, building up an evidence base. And this current one is really looking at what do we know that's happening in schools and how can we really help educators inhabit their facilities the way in which it was intended. So that really speaks to me in my kind of work life, and that I really work with schools to develop this really robust vision of what they want learning to be. Mm-hmm. And the facility then follows, but still there's this missing component of actually getting from point A to point B, because there's a lot of change that has to occur in terms of teacher practice.
Yeah, so you can't just build a nice big open room and not change anything you do.
Exactly. But it happens all the time. People just think, oh, if you build this space, everything will change and it'll be different. And it can be a catalyst. It can certainly help, but there's so much more you have to do. So the research going on in Australia is really looking at how can we build and develop strategies and tools to help educators actually make that journey and shift their mind frames and shift their practice. So the session I did was really sharing some of that research and some of the modeling some of the methods, which uses kind of research-based games and workshops.
And so, I mean, how much of what you do is designing new spaces and how much of it is sort of retrofitting older buildings and that kind of thing?
We do a healthy mix of both, actually. And I think we're seeing more and more of the latter as schools are really hungry and they see the value behind changing their space, but they don't have either the enrollment or the capacity or the funds to do completely new builds. So I think one of the most important things to look at is how can we just retrofit buildings with the double-loaded corridor to provide all these educational opportunities that we're seeing in some of the new builds.
Where are you seeing it work best in terms of new ideas for spaces?
Well, I think you see pockets both in the U.S. and my experience in Australia is that you see definite pockets of innovation at the school level in which you have a really strong leader that provides the support for their staff to inhabit space in a different way. And so the schools in which it's working, I think there's a healthy understanding that risk-taking is okay, and that's paired with constant reflection. So it's really setting up this culture where educators are almost mandated to try new things, and they're given the safety to do that because there's so much pressure on educators to have specific student outcomes. And they're not going to rock the boat. Like, why would they try? There's no incentive for them to try anything new. Mm-hmm. But so you need to have a leader that's setting up that climate to where it's safe to do so. And that's I think, one of the common denominators of all these schools in which things are working well.
And what kind of ideas in terms of use of space are you seeing? So if you could sort of explain what things used to be like and what things, you know, are becoming more like as well.
Yep, absolutely. So the traditional school, which still dominates the architecture, is just, you know, one hallway, identical classrooms. In that classroom, there's one teaching wall, and students are at individual desks all facing in rows. That's still the status quo in many parts.
Sounds like
of the
something
world.
Out of The Shining or something.
Oh, gosh. Just that. Yep, or a prison, one of the two. Neither a great place to be. And no. So what we're seeing instead, and it obviously is on a spectrum when you're depending on if you're in an elementary school or if you're in a high school, but we're seeing a lot of variety of spaces. We're no longer seeing, I'm one educator, I own this classroom, and these are my 25, 30 students. Instead, we're seeing groups of educators cohabitating neighborhoods or communities of space, different lingo for different schools. Mm-hmm. But the concept is you are going to have some spaces that do look like that traditional classroom for those moments in which you need to explicitly share knowledge. But we're seeing so much less of that and so much more of students doing their own self-directed learning and getting that kind of direct instruction from the internet or being able to look something up and working together. And so spaces that support that are a lot more collaborative. We're seeing soft seating and flexible seating and the ability for students to have choice in where they sit. So a lot of, we do student shadowing exercises to where we'll have community members and educators actually follow a student around for the day. And the most common comment was like, damn, they sit a lot and it's so uncomfortable and no one's engaged. And so that's really eye-opening in that you don't want your student to have to sit in a chair all day facing mm-hmm. a wall. You want to provide opportunities for movement and activities and working with one another. And the space then, if you were to look at it, you'll see spaces that are just as diverse as the activities that you wish students to perform.
And who is some of your favorite architects, either in the educational space or just general superstar architects that you love?
Well, I have to give a shout out to DLR Group.
Of course. Why, of course.
Yep. So we do, I mean, DLR does more K-12 schools in the U.S. than any other firm. So we'd really, within our, you know, offices, we have rock star designers. But I think I really saw some amazing work happening in Australia. And what I think is the critical difference between us and them is the collaboration they have among the architecture firms. Mm-hmm. So two of the firms that are doing really amazing work over there, one is Hayball and the other is Clark Hopkins Clark. And even though they're direct competitors, they just knowledge share all the time. So if there's research or findings from one school, they're happy to share that with their, you know, competing firms. And it's creating this climate in which there's so much, the architecture is just lifted up to a higher level than I think you see here. Whereas in the, you know, and by that I mean in the U.S., it's very, at least in Texas, it's quite competitive. So it's hard. Firms keep their research or their knowledge of their processes really close to the chest. And so you have some really great firms doing really great things, but it's still very isolated to them. So that's something I'd like to see more of is these architecture firms. They're not being this one rock star, but instead this collaborative opportunity to where we really just make all schools better.
Why is the existing model so sticky? So, like, why do we still go into those schools and see the, you know, the corridor with all the classrooms that you described?
Why have we not changed?
Yeah.
It's because it's familiar, and familiarity is comforting, and change is really hard. Mm-hmm. And it was so successful at creating students to work in factories and that industrialized model. Like, it was great for that. And we were also able to measure it really easily. So it was a very clear kind of cause and effect. And the state of play is just vastly different. And it's scary that there's no one right answer. So it's putting the onus on these individual school districts and individual schools to really redefine what learning should look like for their community. And that you can't just pluck a model and implement it. It requires a lot of hard work, and change is hard.
And finally, are there any, whether it's Twitter people that you like to follow, or books or resources that you'd like to share with our listeners that might be interested in, you know, getting to know and think about new ways of using space within other schools, universities, other learning spaces?
Well, if you're interested in learning about the research side, so putting that hat on, I would recommend going to www.iletc.com.au. So that's the ILETC stands for Innovative Learning Environments and Teacher Change. So that's that's the link to get to all of the research coming out of Australia. And they have a wide variety of ways of disseminating that. So there is the more academic publications, but there's also fact sheets and one pagers and things that really show a lot of the why. So instead of just this anecdotal why we should change, but actual data showing the benefit that shifting space can have on teaching and learning. One of my colleagues is another PhD student, but she's a longtime educator, is named Anne Nock, and she has a wonderful blog. I think it might just be annnock.com.au, but you could Google her. And she just is, even before I met her as a PhD student, I followed her blog for years, and she's just always, just from the field, very applicable both in terms of space and use of space.
And do you feel that schools or universities are kind of further ahead in this kind of use or reimagining of space?
I go back and forth on that every day. I see some pockets. I've worked with some high schools that haven't wanted to evolve their design because they say, oh, well, our kids are just going to go listen to lectures at university. But then I've also had universities say that students aren't prepared to think differently. It's just pockets. You see some pockets of universities really thinking differently and revamping the way they teach, and others that don't, and same with the K-12. So I don't know who's leading. I think it shifts all the time. If I had to pick one, I'd say K-12 is further along.
Well, thank you so much, Rachel. And if people want to find out more about what you're doing, is there an easy way for them to get in contact or to follow up specifically with you?
I have a woefully outdated blog that I'm ever hoping to post more about, which does have some reflections from my year in Australia, called schoolsandtravel.com. So if you go there, you can also find an email and contact information. Okay. I'm also on Twitter, which is at Ray, R-A-E, for learning. So Ray for learning.
Okay. Perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Yep, sure.
It's now the end of Wednesday, third day of South by Southwest EDU. And I'm delighted to be here with Stefan Turnipseed, amazing name, Exec Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer of Pitsco Education, and Preben Strukman Hansen, the Commercial Director of Cubo Robots. So welcome both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I was here at South by Southwest EDU last year, and coding was everywhere, computational thinking. I was chatting to companies from Japan, and a year later, it'd be interesting to know how you think that conversation's moved on.
Coding, and you pointed out earlier, coding is really almost a funny mix out there. It's very, very busy. There's I can use the term, it looks like a red ocean, if you think about the red ocean, blue ocean that's been written about in the past. We have really gotten into the industry through robotics. We were very successful in bringing robotics platforms to market. And as we looked around and looked at coding, we were not terribly convinced that coding, the way it's being learned today and the way it's being promoted today, was really the most effective because it missed the foundational elements. Mm-hmm. And when we saw Kubo, we saw, here is someone who's designing around the child, but starting at kindergarten. Because what we know, at least in the States and generally worldwide, that by the third grade, girls self-select, boys self-select, and oftentimes girls will self-select out of STEM fields. They'll self-select into other areas. And so we saw this as an incredibly strong foundation that underpins what we already do and gives us opportunity to really grow into a strong hands-on experiential learning for around coding, which we believe is extremely important. It's about children being able to understand the world through the technology they use, more so than understanding the technology. They don't necessarily need to know how that works. They just need to know how it works in the world in which they live. And one of the ways that we've worked together and will continue to work together is taking the product, aligning it to all the US standards, the next generation science standards, the Common Core, if you want to use that, or the state standards. We create content which lives on the very innovative Kidu platform.
It's interesting you mentioned robotics, because in the UK, I think they've just announced a big, I think it was sort of £70 million, pounds, if I remember correctly, to help encourage the teaching of robotics, the understanding of robotics, and sort of our position.
Well, in the US, there is a significant push in the, and have been for a number of years, in the policy arena, where the National Science Foundation, things like that, have really been supporting robotics. We're partners with robotic competition companies like FIRST organization, for Inspiration in Science and Technology, and that organization, we've been involved with that. What we're seeing that's different today is more of a push from industry to drive robotics into the mainstream of what the kids are trying to deal with. For example, collaborative robotics is now being heavily supported by industry, and they're telling us, look, we don't necessarily have to have a child come to us that fully understands all of these things about CNC, for example, numerical control, robotics. We need to understand the basics, but we mostly need them to understand how to work together, mm-hmm. how to be creative, how to problem solve. And that's something that's being promoted by industry. And of course, that's something that we at PITSCO and certainly at Kubo have done, is create products that foster collaborative working. That, for example, Kubo is designed for two, recommended for two people. So there's a lot of money out there. It's coming into that particular area. And then of course there's the major, the major not-for-profits, Digital Promise as an example, mm-hmm. the Partnership for 21st Century Learning, of which I'm a former chairman of.
I think it's a really good relevant question, because I don't think necessarily everything it's political driven, and what I've seen being out there is a lot of preschool partners actually that actually deliver a lot of different preschool material, everything from cardboard to pens to whatever. They really start requesting to build up a kind of a digital category also. And I don't think it's political driven. It's basically driven by a request from kindergarten and early elementary that actually want to implement it. And probably if we look across the last 10 years, I think robotic and when we talk about computational thinking started very much in the middle school, probably earlier, I mean even earlier in high school, down in middle school, then down to elementary, and now it seems to move even further down. From my side, I think what we want to achieve in Kubo is, of course, to make it as natural to learn and about computational thinking, coding, and learning with robots in the same way as it's everyone take it for granted that you learn to read and write. And I think it's a kind of a universal language, so you don't necessarily need to read and write actually before you start learn to code. And as Stefan said, just is about that boys and girls starts to get very selective in third grade, and in that way you maybe lose some of them because it's just too difficult thing.
It's quite interesting from that point of view, because if that introduction of learning about robotics gets younger and younger, whether certain amount of children won't be in nursery or won't be in elementary, so you know, are you looking to also offer a variance of what you do for director parents, for example?
I don't think there is a yes and no. I because when I say yes, it's because I don't see a clear split between what takes place in the school and what takes place at home anymore. You probably saw that before, but I don't really see it. We see a lot of demand from parents that would like actually also to work with the same subject as the children work with in school. And in that sense, but we will not sit on the shelf in a retail market at Toys R Us or whatever. If a parent are looking for the product, they would still need to search and buy it through some of the educational suppliers. Mm-hmm. Because we will focus on the education market, that's the primary. But we will never make a split and say, okay, because you're a parent or private household, you can't buy the product. Mm-hmm. Of course, this shouldn't be that way.
And what are some of the most interesting conversations that you've had this week?
I can start here. I think one of the things which, of course, makes me happy representing Kubo, but that's about being a screenless concept.
Mm-hmm.
And just participated yesterday where they were discussing about all the kind of different technologies that's brought into a school, and it's about they actually implement more, but they never get rid of something. So it just sum up in the end, and makes it very complex. And that's one of the feedback. At least we've got screenless. I mean, just plug and learn, and you are running.
Quite a lot in the press at the moment about you know, sort of the addictiveness of technology and the Center for Humane Technology. And there was a Norwegian new company that's just come out called Hold. I don't know if you've heard of them. They've just launched, which rewards learners for, you know, not being distracted by their phones, by then rewarding them with a kind of marketplace of brand offers, which I did wonder if you then have to, you know, access that through your phone. But it's screenless, and that must be, it's kind of timely at the moment, it seems, sort of the zeitgeist of people's concerns and fears around addictive technology. So
you're exactly right. One of the things that we find is, I've spoken to a number of people around, and there's a tenor to the discussion where not only where EdTech is concerned, but where the children are concerned, and the sense of isolation that children have today as a result of their immersion in technology. And we're beginning to see some signs that say, you know, technology is good. And by the way, technology is one of those words, I'm an engineer by background, and it's one of those words that, frankly, I'm a bit offended that everybody thinks that only applies to computers,
mm-hmm.
because technology has a very proper understanding. It's the physical manifestation of math and science through an engineering process. It does have a name, and it's not just the computers and the things around us. And what we find is that we're using this word a bit loosely, and we're also creating an environment where children are finding, are actually becoming more isolated, and their sense of belonging in the school culture, which in the past was always very present because our interactions were very much face-to-face. And so how do you then deal with that? How do you create technology at the speed to teach technology at the speed that technology is being created? And then how do you create a sense of belonging and community among the children who are using that technology to better understand the technology of their world? And so one of the things that there's a lot of debate going on, one of the things that we are participating in, as a matter of fact, in our organization, is should in fact there be more of this type of technology that uses the tech that's available, but doesn't create an isolating environment.
Mm-hmm.
Being screenless, there's not a sense of isolation. This is a physical device you must interact with. And so now you can deal with hard questions like, what are the ethics of how you treat this device? Mm-hmm. This device, for example, to make it operate, the head comes off. And so the body is the same. You can change the head depending on whether it's coding or letters or numbers or whatever. So now how do we teach a child the proper way to treat this device? Do you just rip the the device apart? The ethics of this become very interesting and a very possible, you know, way of talking. And especially as adults, we can do a fairly decent job of figuring it out. But for children, the work that Dr. Cynthia Brazil did many years ago on the interactions of children with, I think it's Kismet was the name of the robot. Children at very young ages anthropomorphize the device. And so you have to really think through how the child interacts with the device and what the child will transfer human characteristic to the device. And for children, it's something we have to teach them. It's about their mental models. Fortunately, children are very flexible. They can make and break mental models. They're much more flexible than adults are. And one of the things that we've around this conference and that we've talked about is how this allows this opportunity for children and teachers to really have these rich discussions that really will shape a future that these children are going to grow up in. I dare say I will likely never have to deal with the ethics of can you turn a machine, an AI, off or not. Mm-hmm. I likely won't deal with that, although Ray Kurzweil says that by 2045 machines will become self-aware. Mm-hmm. Perhaps he's correct. I don't know. I doubt I see that. But these are issues that these children who are growing up today, at least at some level, are going to have to deal with. Think of geriacare, where you've got robots, essentially, technology, interacting with elderly people. Mm-hmm. What are the ethics of that relationship? What are the ethics of collaborating with a robot in an industry environment where the robot is significantly more powerful than the person? So how do you build in these natural safeguards? These are things that we must teach children at a very early age, because frankly, they're going to have to solve those questions, and they're not going to solve it by memorizing content. They're going to solve it by learning how to problem solve, how to be creative, how to collaborate, how to communicate.
And Elon Musk isn't going to solve all those questions on his own.
No, and it's not. And Elon Musk is not the only one who is asking these questions.
Yeah.
And he needs, just like kids, he needs help. He needs a team of people to work with it. So we want to help create that team of young people who can help him solve it.
And so if people want to connect with you and find out more about your partnership, what you're doing, what's the best way for them to go about doing that?
There are several ways, but one of them is, of course, to go in, if it's in the U.S., on Pittsco Education's webpage.
Pittsco.com,
where they can find more information, or they can actually visit Kuba Robotics' website.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. That's all for this week.
As always,
we welcome comments, feedback, sponsors, new listeners, iTunes reviews, festival sign-ups, and shares. So do feel free to get a goal.
The shipping has been
next time
and has been going for a while. Is that right?
Right when we're talking, the first shipping has taken place.
Oh, really? Oh, wow, how exciting.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Cool.